This is the Disability Visibility Podcast with your host, Alice Wong.
Hey there. Welcome to the Disability Visibility Podcast. Conversations of disability politics, culture, and media. I'm your host, Alice Wong. Today's episode is about curation with artist Anna Berry. Anna is the first curator in residence in a program created by DASH, a visual arts charity in the UK led by disabled people, such as disabled curators, to major visual arts organizations. I spoke with Anna last year in the middle of her residency at the Midlands Art Center, which is located in the city of Birmingham. For folks in the Midlands region of the UK, the exhibit Anna curated, titled Art and Social Change to the Disability Arts Movement, is open now until March 22nd, 2020. You can find details about this exhibit on my website. In our conversation, Anna's going to demystify what curation is. She'll also share experiences of making your access digital during your residency and why we need more disabled curators in the arts. Are you ready? Away we go.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
So, Anna, thank you so much for being on my podcast today.
Thank you so much for having me. Hello.
So, Anna, why don't you introduce yourself, if you don't mind.
Okay, sure. My name's Anna, Anna Berry. I'm an artist, and I'm newly a curator, trying to be a curator. I also write and do a little bit of public speaking and a little bit of music and stuff like that, but mainly an artist.
Tell me a little more about your work as an artist. I know that based on your website, paper is a medium you really like to work with. So tell me about your art.
Yeah, I always find that question really, really difficult because a lot of people in the art world, there's sort of these unwritten rules really about how to kind of brand yourself and how to describe your work, and that you either work with one process and explore different ideas, or you work with one idea and express that through different processes. And I find that because I'm always working with different ideas and different processes, it really kind of resists being corralled into something that's easily like artist statement-y. And actually, I think that's one of the things that leads to people being quite outsider in the art world. And that I remember talking to someone who's in like publishing, and they were saying that they won't publish your book even if it's really good if the marketing department doesn't already know how to market it. Like, they have to know how to brand you and sell you before they're interested in the content. And I think it's quite similar with being an artist like me. I'm so, I guess, almost fragmented from the perspective of someone from the mainstream art world, and that I really can't bring together my work in describing it. I guess a lot of it is very politically engaged, and it's mostly not in art spaces because I'm too kind of outsider for that. So it tends to be kind of quite pop-up or intervention based, or in places that I've just made an arrangement to show stuff in. And I do work a lot with paper. I come back to paper again and again and again. And originally that interest, it was kind of a joke, actually. There was like before sort of internet-based submission things, there was this book called The Artist and Writer's Yearbook, and it had all the kind of magazines and things that you could submit things for. And as someone who really struggles with reading and writing and with assimilating information, I was kind of making a joke that this book was useless to me apart from as an actual building material. So I started really making things from the book and kind of making interventions. And then it kind of moved on to this place where it was kind of quite anti-materialism, anti-capitalism, and that I would spend months and months and months doing this kind of making and this productivity to make a piece that was you know, utterly non-archival, completely ephemeral, couldn't have a value because of that, and sort of questioning ideas about value and labor and what we are putting a value on in life. And then a curator said, oh, it's all this fragility. It's obviously all about your disabilities and your physicality. And I hadn't even thought about that. And I was thinking, God, yeah, she's totally right. And then also just because it's a really ubiquitous object and it's something that people dispose of a lot. And so it has all kinds of different meanings for different people, and it's very available and it's very transformable. So yeah, there's lots of reasons behind the paper thing. Was that too long-winded? I'm sorry.
Not at all. I love it. I think, using everyday objects, things that are so commonplace, and then, transforming it is also, really amazing. You know, I think about origami and how, like, such a simple act of folding can make something so beautiful out of a piece of paper.
Yeah, and that's another big part of it for me, actually, is that dimensional aspect, that you're taking something from two-dimensional space and rendering it in three-dimensional space. And I quite like the kind of metaphor of kind of hidden worlds and hidden aspects of space from all of us. And that definitely comes from, again, aspects of disability and kind of living in a parallel cognition. And that kind of got me really interested in ideas in physics about dimensions that we can't apprehend because of the limits of our cognition, and the kind of act of folding paper in itself and creating a dimension that wasn't there before became quite symbolic to me, both of physics and of sort of aspects of having hidden impairments.
So we're talking about curation today, and I read a piece by you in Disability Arts Online about your experiences as the first curator in residence created by DASH, which is a disability arts program in the UK. So when you first heard of this opportunity, what led you to apply for it?
I'll be honest with you, I'd heard about the opportunity and I did not consider applying for it. I didn't think I would be capable of doing it. I didn't even give it a second thought. And then the people at DASH who run the residency saw me speak about disability and outsiderness in the art world. And they said, have you heard about our program? We'd love for you to apply. And then eventually it was really their kind of faith and encouragement. And I thought, you know what, I've got nothing to lose and maybe I can do this. And so I gave it a shot, and it was really exciting to get it, because suddenly my world had a bit of like a paradigm shift overnight, and I found myself being a thing that was very unexpected for me. And it changed the way I saw myself and the way I saw my capabilities. So it was nice.
Yeah, I don't know about you, but just the word curation, it sounds very lofty, right? It sounds very kind of mystifying and kind of intimidating. So you are an artist and you must kind of, interact with all kinds of people who are curators. But, what were some of your own kind of misconceptions about what curation is all about?
It's interesting. I looked this up at the start of doing the kind of project, because to me as an artist, curators mean gatekeepers and people that you've somehow got to get your work in front of the eyes of. And if you're an outsider and you don't have the right art school pedigree and the right network, you somehow can't reach them, kind of thing. So they did feel like this very lofty, kind of problematic presence. And I was thinking as well, there's a lot of ways in which the term curation has been kind of appropriated in a kind of hipstery kind of way. Nobody just decorates their house anymore. It's they've curated their living room, and it's kind of pretentious, usage in common parlance. But I think originally it just came from, people safeguarding some sort of collection or heritage, in a kind of conserving and interpreting kind of way. It's almost like a caretaker role. And in terms of contemporary gallery spaces, you know, it just means bringing together a show, bringing together work. But then, of course, it is more fraught than that, because it's all about, well, how do you find the people whose work you're going to show, and why show their work and not another artist's work? And it becomes, I really struggle with that, actually, because I feel like all the choices I make, I have to kind of have some really objective justification for, and not just my whim, because the idea that I might be excluding someone by the same kind of, you know, structural prisons of my cognition as other curators would have, you know, excluded me, you know, it keeps me awake at night. But then by the same token, you also have to be okay with the fact that you're allowed your own curatorial style, and actually some of it is subjective and it is your opinion, and you can pick work, you know, just because you like it and it has a visceral effect on you, because that's kind of what art's about. So it's kind of balancing, for me, it's kind of balancing those two things, which are a little bit in opposition.
Yeah, and it must be, I think, there's a lot of tension involved in curation, but, you know, after your, you know, this residency, what does curation mean to you now? Like, what have you kind of learned about what it means to be a curator?
Well, I'm still in the middle of the residency, and the outcome was really flexible, but I decided I wanted to put on a show. So I'm actually curating a show that will start in January on the disability arts movement in the UK, which is kind of centered around late 80s, early 90s, and how a very kind of activist element in disability arts that was kind of borrowing from the tenets of the anti-apartheid movement at the time. And then it had a very kind of immediate effect on legislation, subsequent legislation that was positive for disabled people in the UK. So that will be the outcome of the residency is that show. And I'm being quite ambitious, because I'm doing like parallel programming and like commissioned writing and theatre stuff and a little like symposium for the day. And yeah, so it's kind of full on. I want to say I'm managing, but I'm completely drowning. But, you know, it's all learning.
Can you tell me a little bit more about your kind of relationship with your mentor, who's just a little bit? Can you tell me a little bit about kind of the working relationship with you and Jess?
Yeah, she's great. I'm really, really lucky to get to work with her and get to learn from her. And she's so generous about, you know, just sharing her knowledge and letting me have a go at stuff. But yeah, no, we have quite a shared sensibility, I think, that's helpful. We both enjoy and sort of prize a lot of art that people have been a bit sniffy about in the past. So we like things like ceramics and textiles and some of the things that people have kind of consigned to being craft, with the kind of, you know, snobby idea that craft is less valid than proper fine art, which is more what men do, and, you know, all of that stuff. So we have kind of similar tastes and similar kind of anti-snobbery attitudes about things like craftsmanship and object making.
And, you know, talking about earlier, when you mentioned about resisting brands or resisting kind of labels, how do you resist kind of putting artists in a box?
I mean, I think part of the nature of curation actually is creating a narrative. I don't think you can separate that, because as soon as you put something in the context of something else, you've already got a narrative, if that makes sense. And there's no way to kind of avoid that. So I think what you do is decide on your narrative and then, you know, craft it and justify it and try and make it as fair as possible, but be aware of it. You know, don't try and hide that narrative and present it as something objective.
Yeah. And, you know, did you talk a little bit about developing the narrative for this exhibit and kind of the big kind of idea or theme that you really want the visitors to kind of, you know, come away with?
So, I mean, I picked the exhibition really carefully, because in the main gallery, there's a show about Black musicians who have been kind of underrepresented because of their influence. So they're kind of like super influential, but they haven't been as written into the narrative as they should have been. And so I was, they like at Mac to have kind of connected programming. And so I'm pivoting off the kind of idea of the politics in there, and the fact that the politics and the disability art movement at that time was very related to the tenets in the anti-apartheid movement. And so it's kind of connecting it all up, and it worked well. And in terms of the content of the show, it will be featuring some of the art by the artists who were pivotal to that movement, but it will also be featuring some of the objects of activism that were used at the time. So this kind of t-shirts and rosettes and posters and things like that, and kind of connecting up the political thinking with the art itself, and how that kind of culminated in a little bit of a culture change. So yeah, I'm hoping that the visitors will find that interesting, and perhaps something they haven't thought of before, people from the kind of wider non-disabled arts world. And it's actually quite confronting for able-bodied people, seeing depictions of people with impairments in an art context, which I find really odd, but it is, you know. And it sometimes people complain about you know, for example, when Alison Lapper's depiction was on the fourth plinth, and people were strangely almost offended by seeing a depiction in art of, you know, a sort of non-normative body. So in some ways it might be gently confronting as well, I hope.
Yeah, and I think there's, you know, there are exhibits offered or shows featuring disabled artists, but that's, they're very often art curated by disabled curators. And you know, what do you think is the kind of difference in terms of just perspective and kind of framing the narrative? What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think you've sort of put it in a really brilliant nutshell there. You know, like we all impose our own narrative on the world that's based on our cognition and our life experiences. And when people are being, oh, you know, a little bit ableist or a little bit excluding, most of the time that's not a malicious thing. It's just not something they're thinking about. You know, it's not in their narrative. And so that's the kind of virtue of making sure that there is a little bit of diversity in all walks of life. If you do get people with only similar life experiences, you know, no matter how intelligent and how well-intentioned, there is going to be a poverty of ideas there. You know, as soon as you sort of open things out to people who are, you know, have a different experience, whether it's of identity or disability or whatever, I think it becomes sort of much more than the sum of its parts. It becomes, you know, a very kind of cross-field virtuous circle kind of thing. And it just come from that lived experience that is in some way different to a kind of more mainstream lived experience, I guess.
So let's change gears and talk about that piece you wrote at Disability Arts Online, because, you know, you wrote very, you know, honestly about the struggles you had in kind of, you know, expressing or communicating your access needs during your residency. And, you know, what are some of the accommodations that you need right now to just fully participate in the program?
I mean, the main ones are just them, you know, being a little bit flexible for me. So things like, you know, not having to be there for 8 hours a day, being able to turn up, you know, at 11:30, those kind of things. If I'm tired, I can rest. There's a room booked for me that's like a quiet space, you know. So I just, things that help me manage some of the day-to-day issues with pain and fatigue that I have, that it's just never even occurred to me that there would ever be any workplace that would be that flexible. So it just seemed off the table to me to do anything that involved going into a workplace, really. And I think that's probably true for like 99.9% of workplaces. I think that probably is still true, is that, you know, it's kind of depressing. It's sort of, it almost became irrelevant that I'm a kind of intelligent and competent person, because any value that I have to offer is somehow rendered null by the fact that I, you know, I can't do this kind of, 8 hours a day from this fixed time to this fixed time in this seat. So yeah, that was part of it, is just, just telling people sometimes I'm not okay and it's going to have to be okay for me to be not okay here, kind of thing. And I find that quite a struggle, you know, really, really did. And I'm still finding it quite a struggle because I'm having to kind of rewrite my own little scripts about how I interact in the world and how much I hide, and not just hide, but hide from myself and kind of compartmentalize what I'm feeling at that moment in order to keep going. And it's really almost been like something I need kind of therapy to be able to kind of change and deal with, which has been a real surprise to me. I thought it would just be like, yay, they're offering me access, then, you know, go kind of thing. And actually it's involved at this kind of intense psychological kind of reworking of how I interact with myself and with the world. And there's some aspects that, you know, all the access in the world can't help me with. And that's also being a real reckoning, and it's can stimulate quite a lot of depression in me, because things like sort of executive function things and trying to organize the information, and with that kind of thing, there isn't an access thing someone can do unless I had someone here like injecting themselves into my brain to organize the information. They can't help. And so I land up, you know, cutting out 10,000 sentences and rearranging them physically on my kitchen floor, because that's the only way I can like do it, and it sends me insane and I have a bit of a breakdown. And it's difficult because people are so enthusiastic about wanting to help me, and they're sort of saying, you know, whatever it is you need, you just have to say we absolutely will meet this need. And for me, trying to say back to them, actually there is some stuff that you just can't help with, like there isn't, again, it's kind of utopian thinking that there is no impairment that can't be helped with the right access provision, and actually that's just not true. And and that can make me feel quite upset, because it makes me very aware of the sense that my disabilities, they are what they are. I'm going to wake up with them tomorrow and every day for the rest of my life, and sometimes I don't want to have to think about that doing it every day and sort of telling people you can't help me with this, and sort of feeling that I'm disappointing them if I say, you know, actually I know you want to help, but I don't think you can help with this. And maybe there are ways in which I am just limited that mean I do this job worse than someone who wasn't limited in this way would do this job, and we all have to kind of just accept that, you know, and nobody wants to hear that. So, you know, that's all really quite difficult.
And I also think, you know, the flip side of having these limitations are also ways that shape the way, you know, we do our things. You know, I think that is really interesting about, in my mind, you know, disability culture, is that how much we use what we have, even though we might not have a lot.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting, actually, that idea of you know, the particular needs of your own body kind of forcing your process in particular ways, which then can be really groundbreaking. And actually, one of the artists in my show, he's no longer with us, sadly, but he was one of the first people to adopt digital technology to draw with, you know, like, I don't know, 30 years ago or something, because of his impairments. And so that was really interesting. He was doing something that was artistically groundbreaking, actually, because of how problematic his body was for him in certain ways. But I think also there's a flip side to that, in that if you're not managing to kind of do something creative and inspirational with that adversity, if you actually just need to sometimes say, you know what, it really stinks that my body is making me feel this shit and I can't do this thing that other people can do, sometimes people can treat you a bit as if you're almost betraying the community by being honest about that, by being honest about the fact that your body is disabling you, and it's not just about other people in society, it's what you are experiencing. And I find there can be a lot of like quite gaslighty stuff about how other disabled people expect me to kind of present my experiences and myself in quite a polished way in order to be kind of on message politically.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think this is like kind of unfair to have to like always perform, you know, and I think, you know, being as honest and raw and just, you know, kind of unapologetic. I know that's kind of such a buzzword right now, but I think, you know, it's really hard to be unapologetic about, hey, I'm just feeling really bad or just feeling like a hot mess right now. You know, sometimes I totally feel like a hot mess, and it's okay to dwell on that, you know. I feel like that's, we all need that kind of space to just be, you know, and not for anybody else, but just exist.
Yeah, and I think this can be a sort of tension between that, being able to be as raw and honest and kind of towing the political line. A lot of people see it as kind of like pandering to the medical model or betraying the social model if you are honest actually about, you know, how you are struggling with physical things, and that it's almost like kind of airing the disability movement's dirty laundry or something, and we all have to be like, you know, very bracketed about the nature of our, you know, impairments for the sake of the kind of united front to kind of shift the kind of political rhetoric. And, you know, it's really, I find it really divides me, because on the one hand I completely see the kind of necessity of that and how useful that is, and then on the other side I do feel a bit like I sort of get gaslighted about how I'm supposed to be experiencing and expressing my own experience of my own body.
Well, that's okay. I think that's I think that's not compulsory, right? I think that's another thing too about disabled people. It's like we shouldn't have to feel compelled to make change all the time or any time, you know? I think that's another thing too. These kind of unrealistic expectations that people seem to have just because we're different or the other.
Yeah, and it feels like a responsibility sometimes too, doesn't it? As you say, sort of being, taking on the mantle of fighting the good fight or something. And sometimes I do feel that responsibility, you know, and maybe not totally like, you know, self-flagellate about it, but yeah, it's definitely something I'm aware of. And I had a bit of a transition with that actually on a residency where I would quite often contextualize my work for people, curators and such, by talking about the nature of some of my impairments and my experiences as a disabled person, because it really helped understand where I was coming from and creating the work. And they were so kind of awful and prejudiced about it, and they would be like, oh, you know, you don't really need to mention that bit because, you know, looking at you I wouldn't know, kind of thing. And I just kind of saw the kind of awful prejudice. And I ended up sort of losing it with one of them and just kind of saying, like, if I was gay, would you be literally saying to me, don't be so in my face about your gayness, you know, like you'd be really shocked, right? And it's the same thing. Like, this is actually who I am, and this is my life experience, and this is what I make work about. And the fact that you keep telling me over and over again that this is going to disadvantage me in the art world if I declare this identity, it's actually really offensive. And before that, I had been essentially hiding that identity. And I know loads of disabled artists who absolutely don't declare themselves as disabled artists because they get niched, you know, you get kind of ghettoized. And I kind of made this conscious decision at that point to not do that and to kind of try and force a way into that world that didn't ghettoize me, but that did just feel free and easy about acknowledging the disabled identity. I decided I wasn't going to compromise on that and kind of pretend to not be disabled or pretend that was irrelevant in order to be more effective in my career, I guess. And that kind of is taking one for the team a little bit, I think, but I also feel like quite a strong responsibility to do that after seeing, you know, just sort of curator after curator be so without meaning to, the best one in the world. You know, they weren't kind of like, you know, deeply awful, prejudiced, conservative people, but they actually harbored this huge kind of subconscious prejudice about what disability art meant, and that it absolutely wasn't compatible with having a kind of, you know, serious, rigorous, well thought out practice, and that actually, if I want to be taken seriously in the art world, you know, I've got a jettison being out and proud about that bit kind of thing. And there is a bit of me that's just been like, oh, you know what, fuck you, I'm just gonna be who I am, and at some point I'm gonna get some of you to take me seriously.
As we wrap up, I want to ask you, what's your kind of vision for the future of any more disabled curators? Like, you know, what would you like to see?
Yeah, I mean, what one would hope is that there'll be more schemes like this to get more people from different backgrounds and different life experiences, you know, more kind of integrated into the power structures of the art world. But it's quite difficult because you're sort of playing a game of catch up, because you're kind of asking yourself, well, why are people from such a similar background there in the first place? And then you think, well, we've got to kind of work towards, you know, class equality and kind of racial equality and disability equality and all of these things, you know, from a much kind of earlier point in time. So we get to the point that you're not in the position that a whole industry has a really kind of similar background in its infrastructure. So I don't know. Yes, it's difficult. It's like partly, you know, let's cure society kind of thing. But yeah, also having programs like this that enable people to kind of jump the gap a bit between where they've come from and where they're able to get to.
Great. So Anna, thank you so much for being on my podcast today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a really cool conversation.
This podcast is a production of the Disability Visibility Project, the online community dedicated to creating, sharing, and amplifying disability media and culture. All episodes, including text transcripts, are available at disabilityvisibilityproject.com/podcast. You'll also find out more about Anna's work on my website. The audio producer for this episode is Geraldine Asu. Introduction by Latif McLeod. The music by Vulture Sports Team. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or Google Play. You can also support our podcast for $1 a month or more by joining our Patreon page at patreon.com/DVP. That's patreon.com/DVP. Thanks for listening. See you on the internet. Rocket to the blast stop, stop, drop, dance off. Bye.